This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Grant Tinker can see half his life flash before his eyes just by watching TV reruns. The Mary Tyler Moore Show, The Newhart Show, The White Shadow, St. Elsewhere, and Hill Street Blues are just some of the programs created by MTM Enterprises, the production company he co-founded in 1970 with his then-wife, Mary Tyler Moore. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, calls it the company that set the standards for quality TV. Tinker left MTM in 1981 to become the head of NBC, a job he held for 5 years. He started his TV career in 1949 as part of NBC's first executive training program. He also worked as an ad agency executive and sponsored the Dick Van Dyke Show. Now he's written a memoir called Tinker in Television. The Mary Tyler Moore Show is still so popular, you can see back-to-back episodes on Nick at Night. Here's how the show got started.
Well, it went back actually to CBS's appreciation of Mary and the Dick Van Dyke Show, which had gone off several years earlier. And Mary had done some movies that were okay, but were not great. And then did a try to play in New York, which didn't work. And so she was at liberty when Dick did a special for CBS. And he was exceedingly generous in giving Mary a lot to do in the special. And it sort of reminded CBS of how talented she was. And out of that came what we call a series commitment for 13 shows. I was at the time at Fox Television. And I left Fox to set up a company, really, based on that order for 13 shows. And fortunately, the show worked, stayed on, and then we added shows from there. So it really was, we founded the company on the basis of the show.
You brought together James Brooks and Alan Burns to write the show. What were some of the first ideas they came up with?
I can only remember one of them, which had to do with a stringer for a gossip columnist. That may be not quite accurate, but something like that. It didn't sing, and CBS didn't love it either. And luckily, they dropped it, came back, and then came up with what became the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Well, she was initially supposed to be divorced, wasn't she?
Yeah, that was sort of silly, I thought, because CBS resisted that a lot. I mean, it literally said things like, people will think she's divorced from Rob Petrie. And we solved that problem with them by agreeing, okay, she wouldn't be divorced. She will be coming off a failed affair, or at the end of an affair, and we even saw that guy in the pilot when she sort of brushed him off. So they preferred a failed affair to divorce, strangely, I thought.
How did the network feel about a single working woman?
Oh, I think they were. I didn't have any problem with that concept. They did have a lot of problems when we did the show, which came off very well, the pilot when we finally did it. They did research, as networks always do, and they found all kinds of things wrong, as research frequently does. They found Mary Richards was a loser, and Rhoda Morgenstern was, I don't know whether they used the word ethnic or New York, but they didn't like her, and Phyllis Lindstrom, Cloris Leachman, was abrasive. All the things that made the show as it proceeded bothered them in terms of their research. But we got sort of famous for resisting network suggestions, and we were able to maintain what we had.
How did you know when it was time to end the Mary Tyler Moore Show?
Well, it was just the family. It does become a family when you do one of those multiple camera shows in front of an audience, and you live together all day long. And I don't know, maybe the lesson of the Dick Van Dyke Show, which Carl Reiner and Sheldon Leonard and Dick decided to end after 5 years, perhaps that was in our minds, but we had done 7. I think the creative people, all of whom stayed from the beginning to the end, were looking to move on to other things, and I think Mary felt that that was enough. And from my standpoint, as the guy running the business, we had more than enough episodes to go into syndication.
How many did you need to go into syndication?
Well, about 100 in those days. With anything less than that, you didn't sell as well as if you had more.
Did you think that you know, in 1994 it would be running in prime time on a cable station?
I don't think I did. I was always very proud of that show on behalf of the company, and as I've already said, I didn't produce it. It's my favorite MTM show, and we made some very good other shows. But I actually didn't know that it would be almost a cult show. Sort of a comedy Star Trek, and they've run the sprocket holes out of those episodes on Nickelodeon and other places.
Now, Hill Street Blues, when you had the pilot episode for that, the pilot tested negative, and you even reprint some of the notes in your book.
Right.
So what was wrong with Hill Street Blues, according to the research?
Oh, the pandemonium in the cop house bothered them, which, as you may, at least I remember, as being part of the what was entertaining about the show. The fact that Ferrillo, played by Daniel Trevanti, was not... didn't seem to be in charge. The cops were kind of losers. Also, they just thought everything that turned out to be strong about the show was weak. It's very similar to the Mary situation.
Now, how was it tested? This in front of test audiences?
Yeah, they test them two ways now. They used to do it always in front of an audience, and everybody would have a box, and you turn up a thing when you like something and turn it down when you don't. Now they'll cable it out to, I don't know, maybe 3,000 homes, maybe perhaps less, and then they have reaction from it's like a focus group, but it's done electronically. And I'm not a big believer in slavishly following research. It's one of the things that's wrong with television is that if you throw the decision-making process to the research department, you're not making any instinctive, visceral judgments about programs, which are show business. And many shows that went on to become very successful would never have been seen if that had been the case. I think research is a tool, one of several, but should be used much more modestly than they frequently use it.
So how much pressure did NBC put on you to change Hill Street after it tested poorly?
I don't think so much. Fred Silverman, who had been involved in suggesting he had seen Fort Apache, a movie, it was somewhat similar, and he said, "I wonder if we could do a television version of that." And Stephen Bochco and Michael Kozel created Hill Street based on that suggestion, and we went over and had meetings and said to them, "No, this is going to be a rough show," and we tried to warn them that they might not like everything. I don't think they were ready to sit with it all the first year, which is about what they had to do before the audience found it. They moved it around, which I'm also not an advocate of. I believe in putting a show in one place and promoting it and waiting for the audience to find it, as opposed to making them search. But at the end of that first year, the show had won a lot of Emmys, and that helped the audience find it too.
Hill Street and your show Saying Elsewhere really changed the pattern of dramatic TV in the sense that there were multiple plot lines in every episode, and each episode ended without every storyline being resolved. It would be continued the next week and the week after that, and
right.
It would just like go on forever.
No, that's right. There were stories that arced over a number of episodes. The thing we learned, and I think Stephen, for instance, with NYPD Blue, or certainly with L.A. Law, has done this since, is to have one story that does end during each episode, so that there is closure for the viewer. But meanwhile, you do have three or four other situations going. It's also a way of kind of making it a viewing habit by not resolving all the stories in the episode.
Grant Tinker is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Tinker in Television. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Grant Tinker is my guest, founder of MTM Enterprises and the former head of NBC TV. Why'd you leave MTM to return to NBC and take over the company?
Well, because the chairman of RCA, the parent company of NBC, asked me to, and he caught me at a moment when I thought I couldn't match the 11 years of MTM that I'd already had. I had fond memories of my prior two terms at NBC. I knew a lot of people there, and I was very unhappy as I watched the network decline. And so all of those things gave me this this feeling of wanting to help save the company, which was really going down for the third time. And I went back, and with the help of some very good colleagues, we did manage to save it. In fact, we succeeded beyond our fondest hopes.
What was the empirical evidence?
Well, both the quality shows that we were, the critical acclaim of many of our shows, some of which we've already mentioned, and the profits kept going up.
You say that the move to NBC and the move away from MTM Productions actually cost you tens of millions of dollars. How did that happen?
Well, it happened because I'm stupid. it happened because I did not seek, you know, the kind of legal advice I should have sought about putting my interest in MTM in a blind trust. It just wouldn't fly after a while because NBC was doing business with MTM, not only on the two shows we've mentioned, but on Remington Steel and other projects were in the works. And the RCA lawyers got very nervous about that. And in effect, my choices were leave the NBC with the job undone and go back to MTM, or sell out my MTM ownership. And I did the latter. And because the company had not produced so many episodes that were to follow, and they were therefore not assets yet, I cashed out at a very low level. And the company was later sold for $320 million, and I would have had a third of that $320 million. So that's what I mean by the tens of millions of dollars.
So when Mary Tyler Moore and Newhart and Another White Shadow are on Nick at Night,
I have no interest whatsoever.
You have no financial stake in that.
As a matter of fact, the original principals of MTM don't either. Mary and two other guys, to whom we gave their original interests, when they sold it to the British, they were all out. And then it's since been resold to the company that Pat Robertson runs.
Boy, if I were lucky enough to have produced those shows, I'd feel heartsick if I didn't own an interest in them anymore.
Well, the truth is, I'm human too, and maybe not heartsick, but it took me a while to get over a sort of an anger that I had that I'd worked very hard and we'd succeeded very well, and that I didn't didn't participate in the results. But, you know, life goes on, and I'm still proud of all of the successful shows we made.
I guess you're not broke anyways, right?
No, I'm still eating.
Right. So when you got to NBC to head the company, what were the problems you perceived and how did you try to fix them?
Well, morale was one. Mm-hmm. Everybody was just very sick of losing, and so we addressed that by having a bunch of company meetings, in person and connected by satellite to all the other locations, just letting people blow off steam, ask questions, make complaints, and so on. And we began to, I think, get back a sort of a family feeling that I remembered at NBC in earlier days. And then we began, the first couple of years, we didn't do much at all. We neatened it up and maybe cut some losses, but we didn't, our programs weren't that successful. And then we began to get successful. And as I say in the book, success begets more in television. Because if you have a show like Cosby, you can put something behind it, and that show will almost automatically succeed because the audience flows into it. And as we got what we call building blocks like that, we did build other shows. And then pretty soon we had a very successful network and a quality one because we had recruited mostly quality producers.
You left NBC after it was taken over by GE.
Well, not for that reason, though. I'm careful in the book to say that. I told Thornton Bradshaw, the chairman of RCA, when I took the job, that I would give it 5 years. And I was coming to the end of my 5 years. In fact, I came to the end of it in July of 86. GE, just prior to that, had bought the company. So I stayed a little longer through the transition period and the Washington approvals and other things that were necessary. But I was going to be gone, GE or no GE.
I want to go back to your very early days in television. When you started, television programs were actually being produced by advertising agencies. So what was your job?
Not really many produced, Terry, by advertising agencies, but commissioned by advertising agencies. And they selected and bought the shows, but creative people produced them. Those creative people weren't employees of the agencies for the most part.
So what kind of jobs did you have with the ad agencies?
Well, very similar to the one I would have in the 60s at NBC. We'll take the Van Dyke Show. We had as a client at Benton & Bowles, Procter & Gamble, which had a lot of products to advertise and which underwrote a number of shows. They wanted to own them and therefore have them succeed and be available to sell their products. And we took them the Carl Reiner script for the Van Dyke Show. We persuaded them that this was potentially a good show. And then part of my job was to shepherd it through. And I don't mean I did it alone, but part of Benton & Bowles' job was to follow through with that and have the creative people, Carl and Sheldon Leonard and others, make the pilot of that show for Procter & Gamble. And so, in effect, I was doing the same job that a network guy does now when he orders a program.
You met Mary Tyler Moore, to whom you were married for about 11 years, through the Dick Van Dyke Show.
18 years.
18 years, excuse me.
Terry,
thank you. You were with the company, I guess, for 11 years.
Right.
Okay. So how did you meet her?
I met her when we did the pilot of the Van Dyke Show. Laura Petrie nobody had really thought too much about that because, the star was going to be Rob Petrie, and Mary was cast as Laura Petrie, almost by a lucky accident. Danny Thomas had once read her to play his daughter, and she didn't get the part because Danny said no one would believe she's my daughter with a nose like that, hers being quite different from his, and. When Sheldon and Carl were looking for and not finding Laura Petrie, Danny happened into the office one day and said, "What about that girl with the three names?" And so they called Mary in, and the result was her being cast as Laura Petrie, which that she did, so, I think, so much better and so much more completely and so much more comedically than they had hoped, that it became a more balanced show between office and home, and she really made it. Obviously I'm a suspect source to make this comment, but I think she made a huge contribution to that show.
So when you fell in love and decided to get married, was there anything awkward for you about being professionally involved in a program that your now wife was the star of?
Not at all, because I was at NBC. In Burbank, and Mary was doing the show in Hollywood for CBS. So we were, in terms of work, we were entirely separate. She went one way, and I went the other in the morning.
What were the pros and cons for you of being a business partner with your spouse?
Well, there were no cons, actually. The pros were, one, we succeeded. The show did work, and we were able to found the company on the basis of that show, as I said. And the other one was that Mary, who is a very bright lady, she likes to do her work, and so she left the company, the business, to me. And I don't mean she wasn't aware of what was going on, but she it was not her preoccupation, as it was mine, and so. That was very happy. I'm not sure that's always the case where you're partnered with somebody in a company. It doesn't mean I would never ask her you know, what do you think of this actor, or a question to which she brought some expertise, but she didn't try to look over my shoulder and run the company, and that's, you know, a pro for sure.
And when you separated, did it make it difficult for business?
Well, it made it, yeah, it certainly was awkward. We had a trial separation that I remember is more awkward than the final permanent one. It was 3 or 4 months, and she was still doing her show and driving on and off the lot, and my hours were longer than hers, so I would see her come and go. And yeah, it was sort of that. I remember that as difficult, and I think she does too. But then when we finally packed it in as a marriage, her show had been long since done, you know, was over, and so she retained her interest in the company, that is her financial interest, but there was no connection.
Must be so strange for you to, you know, I don't know if you watch Nick at Night a lot. I know I have it on a lot, and it's always the Dick Van Dyke Show and the Mary Tyler Moore Show. It must be so strange for you to have part of your life so frequently represented on television.
Well, I don't watch it a lot. I don't know why. Yes, I do know why. I sort of deplore what happened to the company after I left, and I don't really want to get into that, except I thought it was very badly handled by people that I had brought into the company and convinced Mary could run it. A couple of very bad choices, and for that reason, because of the you know, a bad taste in my mouth about the company beyond my own presence there, I don't run to watch the shows, which doesn't mean I don't watch some of them, and I'm happy that Mary and I have a very good, friendly relationship. But I tend to look at a rerun of Hill Street, I think, before I would look at some of the comedies.
Do you wish you were? Are you working in TV now?
No, I'm not, and it's a problem. I'm not ready to go to Forest Lawn, but once you run things, it's very hard to go back and be a cog in the machine. Not that anyone's particularly begged me to do so. So I'm sort of standing back and trying to find a big picture that I could get involved in, but not desperately.
Grant Tinker, his new memoir is called Tinker in Television. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.